The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're going to start today with Oprah's Intentions and Oprah's Insider. The grief and sadness of the past week. We cannot turn away from the atrocities we are witnessing, Oprah says. Hello, insiders. Words fail me in trying to express the depth of sadness and grief I have felt this week. My weekly intention cannot capture the gravity of the situation and the crimes against humanity. It impacts all of us, and we cannot turn away from the atrocities we are witnessing. I am utterly heartbroken for the loss of life in Israel. The murderous terrorist attacks by Hamas must be condemned. I am also heartbroken for the deaths of innocent children and civilians in Gaza. This is what I'm praying for: a way forward that ends the violence and the suffering for all the families who have lost loved ones, and for those who are still in despair, hoping for the safe return of those held hostage. Now is the time to take those who are dear to us and love stronger as we continue to bear witness to the need for peace, justice, and the fullness of our humanity. Over in wellness, Dr. Roland Griffiths, whose pioneering research explored the potential of psychedelics, dies at 77 years. During one of his last public appearances this past June, Dr. Griffiths sat down with Oprah to discuss the power of psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, to reframe mortality and produce enduring feelings of human interconnectedness. When one of the foremost pioneers of psychedelics research in the treatment of terminally ill cancer patients was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, the irony wasn't lost on him. Because what some might see as Shakespearean tragedy, Roland Griffiths, PhD, a soft-spoken man of science with a seemingly irrepressible smile, sees only as the greatest of life affirmations. Griffiths had spent decades studying how the human brain responds to mood-altering drugs. He founded the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. After he personally experienced the life-changing impact of meditation, he wanted to further study how altered brain states could affect worldview and spirituality. It became of interest to me to know whether psychedelics would have anything informative to tell me about the nature of this mystery. For lack of a better word, the spirituality. The humbling sense that we truly don't know what's going on here, Griffiths explained to Oprah during a recent conversation. What we found from the very first study is that at high probability, people would take a psychedelic under our setting conditions, being very carefully screened and prepared, and they would have experiences that really shifted their entire sense and worldview. Of course, that all came before Griffiths received a stage 4 colon cancer diagnosis following a routine colonoscopy. Then the doctor became the patient. I had contemplated my own death, but I had no real sense of how I might respond to a diagnosis of this sort, Griffiths said. But he discovered firsthand something his patients facing death had described all along. I can't quite explain it. What occurred was this incredibly opening awakening, if you will, to the preciousness of life, and it immediately became something to celebrate. Griffiths developed a deep sense of gratitude, even in the face of mortality, and a strong feeling of human interconnectedness. Now, as he accepts the inevitability of his death, he is passionate about spreading the message that it is possible to live joyfully while knowing our eventual fate. He is also working hard to raise money for the Roland R. Griffiths PhD Professorship Fund, an endowment to establish a world-class rigorous program of research of psychedelic substances to advance understanding of well-being and spirituality in the service of human flourishing for generations to come. Parts of this article were edited due to time. This is a recipe we're going to put in out of Oprah's magazine, her quarterly magazine. This one's called Hot Pockets. The rice is the provincial dish. Is cooked in the juice of ripe tomatoes and punctuated with garlic, fresh herbs, and black olives. It's Arborio stuffed tomatoes with olives and herbs. The ingredients are 6 medium baseball size beefsteak tomatoes, ripe but firm, 1.5 tablespoons of olive oil, plus more as needed, 1 small onion minced, 3 garlic cloves minced, 1 teaspoon of fresh thyme, leaves chopped, or 1/2 a teaspoon of dried thyme, 1 tablespoon of tomato paste, 1 cup of arborio rice, 1/2 a cup of dry white wine, 3/4 a teaspoon of kosher salt, plus more to taste, freshly ground pepper, 6 large basil leaves cut into strips, 1/2 a teaspoon of Calabrian chili paste, or 2 Calabrian chilies minced, or a big pinch of red pepper flakes, and that's optional. 1/4 cup of pitted oil cured black olives chopped, 1 cup of small cherry tomatoes, and that's optional, and 1 ounce of Taleggio or Fontina cheese, optional, cut into small pieces. Here are the directions. Heat the oven to 375 degrees with a rack in the middle. Cut a thin slice off the top of each tomato and reserve. Cut along the wall of each tomato, leaving a 1/4 inch thickness around the side. Using a melon baller, a spoon, or your fingers, hollow out the inside of the tomato into the jar of a blender or food processor. If necessary, cut a very thin slice off the bottom of the tomato so it sits flat. Set the hollowed tomato aside. Puree the tomato pulp until smooth and push through a sieve to strain out the seeds. Number 2. Heat a large 12-inch skillet or wide, shallow saucepan over medium heat. Add the oil and sauté the onion until softened, 5 to 6 minutes. Add the garlic and thyme and cook for 3 to 4 minutes. Number 3. Add the tomato paste and cook for 2 minutes, stirring constantly. Add the rice and a drizzle of oil and cook, stirring for 2 minutes. Add the wine and cook, stirring until evaporated, about 1 minute. Number 4. Measure the tomato pulp. You'll need 3 cups, and water if you have less than that. Add the liquid to the rice and salt and pepper to taste, bring to a boil, and reduce to a simmer. Cook for about 20 minutes until the rice is still slightly al dente and just thick enough to mound a bit. It should not be completely soupy. Stir in the basil, Calabrian chilies or red pepper flakes, and the olives. Adjust the seasoning. Number 5. Arrange the tomatoes in a baking dish and spoon the rice mixture into them, dividing it evenly. Add 1/4 cup water to the baking dish. At this point, you can top the tomatoes with the reserved lids or add some whole or halved cherry tomatoes to top and drizzle with a little oil. Bake for 40 to 45 minutes until the tomatoes start to slump and the edges look juicy. If using the Taleggio or Fontina, remove the pan from the oven in the last 5 minutes and dot the tops of the tomatoes with the cheese. Return to the oven to finish baking. Serve hot or at room temperature. You can cover and refrigerate the baked stuffed tomatoes for up to 1 day. To reheat, place the tomatoes in a baking pan and drizzle a tablespoon or 2 of water around them. Cover with foil and bake in a preheated 350-degree oven for 15 to 20 minutes. Uncover and bake for 10 minutes longer until heated through. And it serves 6 to 8 people. In TV and news, a documentary about Tyler Perry's life is hitting screens soon, and it's beyond inspiring. Tyler Perry has launched many stories onto the big screen, and now his own story is getting the same treatment. Maxine's Baby, the Tyler Perry story, a documentary based on his life, is coming to Amazon Prime soon. The trailer for the documentary officially launched with a sneak peek into the heart of the story. Perry's mother, Willie Maxine Perry, was passed away in 2009, as noted in the nearly 3-minute clip. Perry's childhood was marked by abuse, the trauma of which followed him into adulthood, but he pushed forward to create box office hits many times over, even as his mother was dying before his eyes. Perry has previously spoken about his mother's influence in his life. When he accepted a humanitarian award at the 93rd Academy Awards, Perry shared that his mother instilled empathy into him from a young age. "My mother taught me to refuse hate," Perry began. "She taught me to refuse blanket judgment." Having been his professional colleagues and close friends for years, Oprah and Gail are both making an appearance in the documentary. The trailer gives a glimpse into their love and support for Perry, with a snippet of Gail saying, "There's no denying the talent and the power of Tyler Perry." You can see the full trailer for Maxine's Baby, the Tyler Perry story, below, and watch the documentary when it launches on Amazon Prime on November 17th. Under Wellness, 5 things you need to know about breast cancer right now. The statistics and headlines about the disease seem to change constantly. Here's what experts want us to focus on today. Every 14 seconds, a woman somewhere in the world is diagnosed with breast cancer. It's the most common cancer worldwide, with an estimated 2.3 million new cases each year, and rates have been slowly increasing over the past 2 decades. The good news is that death rates are dramatically decreasing. There's been a 43% decline since 1989. This is in large part due to improvements in both detection and treatments, says Eric Winner, MD, and that's W-I-N-E-R, director of Yale Cancer Center and president and physician-in-chief of Smilo Cancer Center. In honor of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, here are 5 more timely facts. Number 1. At-home genetic tests for breast cancer are not always reliable. Direct-to-consumer genetic tests are everywhere, and they promise to reveal whether you're at risk of developing a whole host of diseases, including breast cancer. But don't count on them to sound the alarm or provide reassurance. Most of the popular ancestry tests only check for 3 very specific breast cancer mutations in the BRCA1 and 2 genes that are common only in women of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, says Joy Larson Haidle, H-A-I-D-L-E, past president of the National Society of Genetic Counselors. If that's not your background, the test will be largely worthless because it misses up to 90% of all other mutations, she explains. As a result, you could be lulled into a false sense of security. On the flip side, if you get a positive result, you could be propelled into an unnecessary state of panic. Many women assume that if they test positive for a BRCA gene mutation, they automatically get breast cancer, says Heidel. But a large new study published this past September in the journal eClinical Medicine found that while women who carry one of these gene mutations have a higher than average risk to develop breast cancer by the age of 60, it's actually lower than previously thought. In some cases, as low as 18% if there's no other family history of the disease. The average lifetime risk for the general population is 13%. The bottom line, if you're concerned about your risk for breast cancer, talk to your doctor, advises Heidel. They can refer you to a genetic counselor who will take your family health history, advise whether or not genetic testing is appropriate, and, if you do get it, help you interpret the results so you don't rush into preventative action that isn't necessary. Number 2. Self-exams are still essential. For decades, women were told to check their breasts every month. Remember those shower cards your gym teacher handed out? That changed in 2009 when the United States Preventive Services Task Force came out against the guideline, citing research that found that self-exams didn't decrease deaths from breast cancer, but did increase unnecessary breast biopsies and anxiety among women. Breast cancer specialists beg to differ. Many women do find their own cancers, points out Maxine Joshelson, MD, Chief of Breast Imaging Services at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. In addition, a lot of women switch doctors frequently, which complicates things. It's good for women to know what their own breasts feel like so they can tell a new provider if they feel something suspicious, she adds. Joshelson recommends that you do it around the same time every month, usually about a week after your period, so that you aren't thrown off by hormonal lumps and bumps. Number 3. dense breasts require additional screening. If you've been told you have dense breasts but have never really understood how that impacts your health, here's the gist. About 50% of women have dense breasts, per the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're more common in younger women, since breasts naturally become fattier with age. For unknown reasons, women with dense breasts have a higher chance of developing breast cancer. This cancer can also be harder to detect on mammograms because dense breast tissue masks the disease. Breast cancer isn't more deadly among women with dense breasts, but extra vigilance is a must. The only way to tell whether you have dense breasts is to have a mammogram. If you do, you should still have an annual mammogram, but your doctor may also recommend one of the following tests. Breast ultrasound. This is widely available, relatively inexpensive, and finds about 3.5 additional cancers per 1,000 women, notes Joshelson. The problem is they also often find a lot of things that aren't cancer but look like it, so when women end up having unnecessary biopsies. Breast MRI. It picks up more cancers than an ultrasound, usually an additional 16 to 17 cancers per 1,000, compared to just a mammogram, explains Joshelson. But they're very expensive and typically not covered by insurance unless you are considered very high risk. Number 4. Black women are more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer at younger ages. While the actual rates of breast cancer are the same in black women as in white women, black women tend to develop the disease earlier and die at a faster rate, notes Aluchi Oke, and that's the last name is spelled O-K-E, MD, an oncologist at the University of Texas, MD, Anderson's Cancer Center. One big reason? They are more likely to develop triple-negative breast cancer, which tends to be more aggressive and have a worse prognosis, she explains. Another reason is healthcare disparities. A 2021 study published in the Journal of the American College of Radiology found that black women were at least twice as likely as white women to experience delays in getting a mammogram, which raised their risk of death. One big barrier is lack of health insurance. We know black women are more likely to be uninsured compared to white women, explains Oke. They may also have less access to mammograms, especially if there's no health facility near them that offers one. If you don't have health insurance, there are centers that offer low-cost or free mammograms. One option is the National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program. That telephone number is 1-888-842-6355. Again, that number is 1-888-842-6355, which provides cancer screenings for women without health insurance. Number 5. Breast cancer rates may be on the rise in younger women. Rates of women under the age of 50 diagnosed with breast cancer rose slightly from 2010 to 2019, according to a 2023 study published in the journal JAMA Network Open. An increase in screening could be one explanation, says Weiner. But late-stage breast cancer diagnoses in younger women under the age of 40 have been climbing for about 4% each year from 2000 to 2019, per the American Cancer Society. There are no clear-cut answers to explain this trend. The good news? We've developed newer and better treatments in the past 5 to 10 years to treat these types of fast-growing cancers, says Weiner. The pace of scientific discovery keeps getting faster and faster. I'm optimistic that in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll have even more groundbreaking treatments. Over in work and money. 6 financial beige flags and what to do about them. How to speak up when you notice something odd or even worrying about your partner's money habits. Among the many phrases TikTok has launched into the lexicon, see Almond Mom, main character, few may be as relatable to someone in love than beige flag, the term for a partner's quirkier, if mostly innocuous, traits. They are the milder cousins of red flags, which are things a partner does that are not okay and may be breakup fodder. Usually beige flags are minor, day-to-day eccentricities, a new flame has to stop the microwave before it beeps, for example. But what happens when they manifest in a partner's finances? Do beige flags carry more weight when they impact one's money, especially if you pool your income? And how should you react if you notice one? We asked mental health experts and financial pros how to handle a few fiscal foibles. The flag. Your partner rarely buys groceries and orders from Uber Eats almost nightly. The fear. My partner is a careless spender with zero budgeting skills. The fix. The key here is to separate indulgences that signal poor financier habits from ones that just don't jibe with your own priorities, says Dasha Chernovskaya, a Boston-area licensed mental health counselor whose specialties include premarital and financial counseling. We think of habits as objectively good or bad, but they're often subjective, she says. A saver might freak out about eating out so much, whereas a spender could see it differently. To suss out the situation, says Chernovskaya, try expressing curiosity instead of making assumptions. For example, simply ask why your partner doesn't cook much. You might feel differently about their eating habits if they admit they hate cooking, don't know how to cook, or are simply too exhausted at the end of a long work day to cook. Also, consider this behavior in context. Do their other spending habits seem reasonable? Do they seem to pay their bills on time? If the answer is yes, ordering out may just be their thing. On the flip side, it could be a sign of not knowing how to budget, Chernovskaya says. And the spelling of that name is Chernovskaia. If you and your partner are mingling finances in any way, you may want to have a discussion about how the two of you together can create a vision of your financial future. If your partner is flexible about talking about their spending habits, be sure to talk about yours as well. That's a good sign, Chernovskaya says. If they're not open to talking about it, that's a red flag. The flag. You find a years-old 401k enrollment form in your significant other's sock drawer. The fear, my partner doesn't take saving for the future seriously. The fix. First things first, don't panic, says Norziati said. A psychotherapist in New York City, that last name is spelled Norhayati. There are several reasons a person might not have a 401k with their current job. Maybe they don't have the money to save for retirement right now, but fully intend to work toward that goal in the future. Maybe they have other retirement accounts you don't know about. I've had jobs where the contributions weren't worthwhile, so I set up my own retirement account on the side, Sed says. The point is, if it's important to you to know more, a thoughtful, non-judgmental conversation is in order about your partner's views on saving for the future. A lighthearted, hey, what else do you have in your sock drawer? Time capsule will get the ball rolling. The flag. Your beau is carrying small balances on several credit cards and thinks that is just fine. The fear. This credit spending habit is going to snowball into serious debt. The fix. Some people think it's just fine to have a certain amount of debt. Others are very nervous about having debt of any kind, says Liz Higgins, a Dallas-based licensed marriage and family therapist. The question is whether you need your partner to agree with you on the subject. How do you find the answer? Honor and express your needs and listen to your partner's thoughts with curiosity, Higgins suggests. Debt in and of itself is a huge, blaring red flag. But your feelings about debt may be more complicated than you realize, and figuring out what you can and can't live with takes some soul-searching. The more serious a relationship becomes, the more valid and imperative it becomes to explore your feelings and behavior around debt together, she adds. If you find that you can't budge, then this beige flag is likely a red one. The flag. Your partner lies about something money-related, like saying they saved up for their home down payment themselves, but you learn their parents helped out, or that their new bag cost $200, but you found a receipt for $500. The fear? Maybe they're fibbing out of embarrassment, but what if they're hiding a much bigger money issue? The fix. Adam Kohl, that's K-O-L, a certified financial therapist and couples financial coach in Florida, highly recommends talking about what you've discovered rather than letting your question and confusion fester. You may not want to talk about it, you may worry it will be awkward, but if you don't discuss it, it will stick around in the back of your mind, he says. Talking about the situation allows you to address it. See if you misjudged the situation and learn why your partner lied. For instance, maybe your partner feels insecure that they didn't pay for their home on their own. You can then decide if this deception belongs in the forgivable little white lie category or if it's one beige flag too many. The flag. At a party, someone raves about a new investing app, and before the night is over, your date has downloaded it and invested $1,000 without doing an ounce of research. The fear, my partner is financially reckless, naive, or both. The fix. Cole stresses that this, too, is a situation in which asking questions without judgment is the key to gaining clarity. You might ask, what did so-and-so say that made you want to invest with this app? How did you choose the amount? Don't get me wrong, you shouldn't concoct a bunch of reasons why this was a smart choice and ignore the information in front of you, but it can help to have a conversation and let your spidey sense tell you what might be going on, he says. This is one more piece of data to help you decide if you and this person are a good fit. The flag. Your new partner sheepishly asks to borrow money to cover car repairs, admitting that they don't have any savings. The fear, my partner is irresponsible with money and now I'm his sugar mama. The fix. Depending on what you know about this person and what happens next, this flag might be a little more red than beige. Call it terracotta. Asking you for money early in a relationship doesn't automatically make someone a swindler or scammer, but it's best to proceed with caution. If your goal is understanding, says Damona Hoffman, a dating coach and host of the Dates and Mates podcast, ask them, why do you need this from me? What are your expectations about it being repaid? Will this change the dynamics of our relationship? Those are legitimate questions, and they'll also tell you a great deal about the seriousness or lack thereof with which your partner approaches money. That's a very different conversation than I had this bill I couldn't pay, Hoffman says. You're seeing whether this person has a plan and how they think about the future. Back over in wellness, why we should all be traveling to Savannah right now. Known for gracious architecture and shaded public squares, America's first planned city is quickly becoming the South's newest and oldest food and art destination. A blonde, middle-aged man in khakis and a striped polo shirt sits at a grand piano in the middle of the light-filled atrium in the Savannah Hilton Head International Airport and plays the rambling opening notes of Fats Domino's classic, Walking to New Orleans. I feel like I've stepped into a film set as I roll my luggage across the red brick town square and past the storefronts, which are designed in a blend of local Georgian and Southern Gothic revival traditions, and not entirely unconvincing. After descending an escalator out into the gentle spring air, I meet my Uber driver, a gravel-voiced grandmother of two with faded shoulder tattoos, and have my first brush with Southern hospitality. If you like an alcohol drink now and then, she drawls, a wad of chewing tobacco lodged in his lower lip, you could do worse than the slushy from Wet Willie's. She has my attention. Doesn't take but maybe two to get you feeling pretty right, she adds, as she sizes me up in her rearview mirror. She's from Savannah, she tells me, and used to ride in the St. Patrick's Day parade. I picture the girl she was on her horse, surrounded by young men from the nearby Fort Stewart Army Base, as she describes their faces covered with lipstick from the town women, because it was good luck to kiss a soldier back in the day. I note how beautiful and seductive the Spanish moss is as we exit from the highway onto the streets of town. She catches my eye and says sternly, "Don't lay in it and wallow in it. Don't want to see you go home with chiggers. Even if you find you a good-looking man, don't do it." But if it were to happen, she swears by covering the bites with clear nail polish, which is, by her estimation, the only way to suffocate said chiggers. Later research reveals them to be tiny insects that lodge themselves under the skin and cause almost unbearable itching. As we pull up to the hotel, I am struck by the sheer, almost perfect beauty of downtown Savannah, dubbed America's first planned city for its gridded streets and copious shaded squares. There is an oft-sighted Gothic kind of romance in that Spanish moss draped from the trees, cobblestone streets leading to squares upon squares, and the stately Georgian brick houses festooned with fanciful ironwork and stairways that curve into the front door. It occurs to me, the first time maybe ever, that I've traveled all over Europe, Asia, and Africa, and yet have barely ventured into the American South. The thing about America is that you can be as close as a 2-hour flight away and still arrive feeling like a foreigner, especially when you're going from the North to the South. And like with most storied places, our experiences of the American South, its charms and fraught history differs depending on your particular entry point into the culture, and begs the question of how we behold the beauty of a place head-on without averting our eyes away from a complicated past. The truth is, I was skeptical of the near breathless pace of the itinerary when I was first invited by New York-based travel specialist Pryor to join a 3-day trip. Pryor, which is well known in the style, food, and celebrity circles for singular insider experiences around the world, was piloting a new program with a group of Capital One's Venture X-Card members. In just 2.5 days and 3 nights, we travel, often with cold drinks in hand, through iconic squares of the downtown area into private dining rooms of restaurants that otherwise require reservations months in advance, and up the stairs of historic houses for private tours not usually accessible to the public. The thoughtful curation of Pryor's team and co-founder and CEO David Pryor himself delivers pretty much instantly on the promise of insider access, namely into the heart of the food and art worlds. It is through the chefs and artists putting a distinctly modern stamp on a city that I find my way into this achingly beautiful of complicated place. For the legion of fans of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, yes, our first night there is indeed a private tour of the parlor floor and garden of Jim Williams' beautifully restored Mercer Williams house. Each room's color, mixed by Williams himself, recalls the house's original look. I can almost feel Williams' guests at his famous parties in the 1970s and 80s brushing past me as I take in his collection of everything from china plates recovered from a famed shipwreck to brilliantly sourced sculpture paintings and even taxidermy. We follow our tour guide, a tall man with a pork pie hat and details about Savannah and Georgia's founder, James Oglethorpe, at the ready, through the squares and into the other houses as he recounts the history behind the War of Independence, statuary, and the influence of the Freemasons throughout the architecture and city planning. In true Southern fashion, we are greeted at every stop with a delicious Chatham Artillery Punch, a Savannah staple that adds the triple threat of cognac, rum, and bourbon to a champagne base in an oddly refreshing blend. By the time we arrive at our private room at Mashama Bailey's, the group is in high spirits. The James Beard Award-winning chef who greets us with a giant smile is poised, not unlike a dancer or a toreador before a big performance, but with the ease of someone who loves what she does. Housed in a 1938 Greyhound bus station, the space itself, with its soaring ceilings and polished Art Deco details, is a marvel. We gather in the diner bar part of the station, tucking into windowed, tufted leather booths facing a long countertop. There is not a single dish that does not shine on its own. In one standout, Bailey updates the classic Southern staple of grits with seared foie gras, and in another, her crudo with green Caesar mayo croutons and herbs balances refreshness with just the right amount of tangy creaminess and texture. Bailey grew up primarily in New York City, but spent much of her childhood with her mother's family in Georgia, and traces the roots of her cooking lineage to time in the kitchen at her grandmother's house in Queens. Given the opportunity, after formal training at ICE and cooking with mentors like Gabrielle Hamilton at New York's legendary restaurant Prune, Bailey came to Savannah to partner in the Gray. From the beginning, her vision was clear. A soulful update on Port City Southern food, with an emphasis on seasonal and regional ingredients. Hanging in a hallway in the restaurant, there is a framed Greyhound bus first aid kit, which belonged to Bailey's grandmother, who was a licensed nurse in the 1960s. It honors just how far the celebrated black female chef has come since Savannah's desegregation in 1963. Friday morning kicks off with a tour of the Bonaventure Cemetery, which was founded in the mid-19th century on a former plantation by the Wilmington River, Our guide looks like a cross between the rock singer Meatloaf and, in his period black morning coat and matching waistcoat, a Dickensian soothsayer. With theatrical flourish, he regales us with stories of the lives and deaths of Savannah's native sons and daughters, like crooner Johnny Mercer of Moon River fame, and writer Conrad Aiken, and directs our attention to the alignment of obelisks and the evidence of entire Masonic libraries and crypts deep below the surface. Our guide points to small iron hooks, some of which still have bells attached to them, tucked in behind some gravestones. Years ago, he claims, the bells were attached by string to the body of the deceased, just in case they weren't quite dead. After a communal luncheon under the Southern Live Oaks at Chatham Square, we set out into the downtown design district, where the prior team has curated an impeccable list of antique, vintage, and contemporary design shops for us to explore at our own pace. My favorite is V&J Duncan Antique Maps on Madison Square, where rooms spill into rooms of an 1850s townhouse, each one piled high with antique prints, maps, and books. Asher Plus Rye, which is located in a beautifully updated old gas station on Whitaker Street, sells a hand-picked selection of furniture, housewares, and clothing from Scandinavian, Japanese, and American designers and artisans. Following a much-needed disco nap, we dress for dinner and hop onto an old trolley car to Reynolds Square for dinner at the Old Pink House, one of the few remaining 18th-century mansions so-called for the pink cast of the red brick bleeding through white stucco. Midway through dinner, a woman dressed in full skirts and a cinched 18th-century-style bodice waltzes in, fan in hand, to ask if we want a song. As she opens her mouth and starts to sing Otis Redding's The Dock of the Bay, all of us freeze, awestruck by her rich vibrato. After our applause dies down, she invites a brave enough soul to sing with her for the next song. One of the men in our group, a black man in his 50s from Florida, who is here with his husband, shyly volunteers, then retreats. When pressed, he says he'll sing with her if we turn the lights down. Someone jumps up and turns them to low. They're an odd couple, she in her 18th-century finery and he in tan shorts and a pastel shirt. With one hand pressed nervously to his leg and the other to his heart, he begins to sing Amazing Grace. She watches him closely, tapping her fan against her hip, and a few bars in, she unfurls it and joins him in perfect harmony. It occurs to me as I look at the expression on the faces of my fellow travelers that what could easily have been dismissed as tourist kitsch is instead a transcendent moment. And of course, the irony of two perfect strangers singing one of the most enduring anthems of hope in a home built at the height of slavery isn't lost on any of us. Saturday morning, we set out to visit the Savannah College of Art and Design, known widely and affectionately by the acronym SCAD. SCAD has not only emerged as one of the country's best art and design schools, but also is beloved for its part in the regeneration and preservation of downtown Savannah since its purchase of a single brick building on Bull Street in 1979. After brunch and drinks at the university's museum, Kristen Poitras, and that's P-O-I-T-R-A-S, who is the director of museum programming and operations and a student docent, led us on a private tour of the impressive collection, the highlights of which were installations from New York sculptor Rachel Feinstein, Moroccan photographer Hassan Hajjaj, and young painter Chase Hall's stunning debut exhibition. From SCAD, we head to our lunchtime destination, Back in the Day Bakery. Cheryl Day, the Diane of Southern Baking, is your friend. Within 10 seconds of meeting me, she alerts me to the fleck of kale stuck in my teeth. Then, after I repeatedly scrape at the wrong crevice, she guides my finger with hers towards the right one. After you spend the morning with her, the important truth you come away with is that real biscuits, at their very finest, are the American croissant. We are there not only for a private lunch, but to learn from the master. Day carries us through our cutting in of cold butter and layering with an ease that teaches sense and feel alongside precise measurements. A group of grown-ups kneading and folding dough makes for a very happy room and lots of laughter. The fruits of our labor culminate in the form of BLT biscuit sandwiches, slathered in house-made mayo, thick cuts of bacon, and fresh-from-the-vine tomato, which we wolf down with ice-cold Georgian sweet tea. Carrying bags filled with treats from Dave's shop, I walk from square to square, determined to work up an appetite for the final dinner. By now I have a rough sense of where I am in relation to the hotel. I let myself wander, looking down alleyways with climbing vines tumbling from back terraces and up at the statues that anchor each square, which are mostly of men on horses celebrated for their Revolutionary War heroics. The tours we have been on, and amazing as they are, elide mention of the history of slavery in Savannah, maybe because it is so thoroughly interwoven, or perhaps out of fear that anything good would be eclipsed by the indisputable horrors. As a German citizen who has now spent the bulk of her life in America, I can understand that ache and shame and the fear that the evil good binary will somehow strip, in the case of Germany, the mountains and the rivers of their beauty or the writings and music of their poetry, and on a deeply personal level that one's own warm and fuzzy nostalgia for a place cannot coexist with not-so-distant past horrors. But I can say from experience that there is great liberation in acknowledgement and humility. And being of a place that has elevated reparations to official policy and requires fact-based history as curriculum, I can also attest to how much it unifies rather than divides. Histories of place are not unlike those of families in terms of their repetition and denial, and require those rare, brave, creative souls to disrupt patterns. I think about how Southern food, as we understand it today, has its deepest roots in the traditions of the enslaved and their descendants, who cooked in the kitchens of wealthy whites while paradoxically establishing the most beloved of traditions from whatever scraps were left. Both Day and Bailey, two major African-American chefs, talk openly about the significance of representation and about making food that takes the best of both African-American and European-American tradition and tells a funny story of being the face of the place and not just the invisible background. Significantly, both chefs are committed to a mission beyond their own enterprises. Bailey serves as chair of the board for the Edna Lewis Foundation, a nonprofit that honors the legacy of its namesake for awarding grants to African Americans in the fields of cooking, agriculture, food studies, and storytelling. Day, who has also collaborated with Bailey on Edna Lewis events, is a co-founder of Southern Restaurants for Racial Justice. Similarly, Chase Hall's beautiful and moving exhibition at SCAD shows us new ways for people to experience and claim their roles. To wit, accompanying the paintings are quotes on the walls from community members with personal insight into the scenes and figures depicted in the paintings. Beside one painting titled Cooking with Gas, which depicts four black chefs cooking, is a poignant quote from a female cafeteria cook that sort of says it all. To see us cooking in the places where we couldn't even go in to sit, not even look in the windows, it's bringing back a lot of memories about where we've been and where we're still going. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Over in relationships, try this in bed tonight. For this author, reading aloud with his wife every night fosters a new kind of intimacy. My wife and I, like most people, look for ways to dull the world's sorrow and sharpen its joys. We make music, we make food, we make love. We walk, we hike, we bike, we scroll Instagram, we watch TV. But one of the most enduring and successful practices we have fostered as a couple happens to be one of the simplest. We read, out loud and together. Over the past decade, Liz and I have read exactly 21 books aloud, which I know because I am the type of writer-reader-book nerd who gains immense pleasure in tracking such details. While we occasionally read at the beach, in a park, or on a mountain in a tent, 99% of our reading happens at night, in bed, passing a book back and forth, trading off one page at a time. The practice has had a subtle yet profound effect on our sleep, our mental health, our attention spans, and our marriage. While I realize that reading aloud with your partner might sound a bit odd or lifted from the pages of a preachy, unhelpful self-help book, The 7 Must-Do Eccentric Habits of Highly Successful Couples, let me be upfront. First, it's not like we claim to have all the answers because we read to each other. We have every problem and issue common to any relationship. Second, reading aloud together is surprisingly easy. In fact, it's one of the oldest, most natural practices we human beings can enjoy. When people think of reading out loud, we generally imagine reading to children, whether as part of a bedtime routine or in the classroom. As a fourth grade teacher, the read aloud portion of the day is my favorite. But out loud storytelling is one of humankind's oldest forms of entertainment for children and adults alike. Our ancestors did not experience the Odyssey or the Epic of Gilgamesh by themselves, silently turning papyrus leaves in a cafe. Storytelling, for much of history, has been a collective experience, listening and envisioning together, all picturing similar but not identical versions of the same narrative. Liz and I read our first book together in 2012, when our bed was a mattress on the floor of an apartment we shared with friends. The Teachings of Don Juan, by the anthropologist Carlos Castaneda, follows the author's dive into the mystical world of shamanism in the deserts of Mexico. Our 21st book, finished last spring in our new bed in our first home, could not have been more different. Hidden Sins, a romance thriller by the politician and activist Stacey Abrams. In between, while living in four states, working a half dozen jobs, and moving across the country more than we can count, we have read two YA trilogies, The Hunger Games and Shadow and Bone, a slew of thrillers, Gone Girl, The Woman in the Window, The Other Woman, an excellent memoir, Crazy Brave, some fantasy novels, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, Six of Crows, more Carlos Castaneda books, one sci-fi romance mashup, Landline, and a comedy thriller, Skinny Dip. 21 books, page by page, word by word, night after night after night. We choose our read-alouds with great care. At only a few pages a night, Liz and I may live with any given book for many months or longer. We can always ditch a book, of course, but this happens less than expected, partially because bad books, like bad movies, can be fun to experience out loud and collectively. Over the years, we've only given up on a few novels. I write and read mostly literary fiction, but literary fiction, with its layered backstories, leaps in time, descriptive prose, and character interiority, does not always lend itself for bite-sized chunks late at night. Some great novels, the Satanic Verses, to take one example that I am hereby warning you against as a read-aloud, become impenetrable when swapping pages. For opposite reasons, some books are too terrible to read aloud. We were giddy to start the 50 Shades trilogy, but couldn't make it past the first half of book one. Truly awful writing, it turns out, evolves entirely new phylums of awfulness when spoken aloud. It was funny at first. We knew it would be bad. Bad was what we wanted, but not that bad. Even when we do pick a winner, after trading a few pages back and forth, one of us often starts drifting off. Moments like these are when reading aloud with your partner becomes a wonderful opportunity to practice your improvisation skills. This happened often during the Hunger Games books. As soon as I sensed Liz falling asleep, I could begin editing in real time, turning Catching Fire into 50 Shades. "Katniss," Peeta whispered, "take off your pants." "Geez," I gulped, "I thought you'd never ask." Peeta grabbed my butt. "Stop talking and start stripping." It should come as a surprise to exactly nobody that we are a scrolling, swiping society that moves much faster than our biological evolution ever intended. Liz and I have found that reading aloud, even two pages a night, works as a potent antidote to the speed of contemporary life. After a long day apart, we are together, in bed, off our phones, legs entwined beneath the covers. We're done talking about today. We're not discussing tomorrow. Not the frozen blueberries we need from the store, not the car that needs snow tires. We are together, on the cusp of traveling through the same imagined world for a few slow pages. We have to collaborate to remember what happened the night before. We have to pause for punctuation and effect. We must think three or four times before leaping headfirst into the pronunciation and meaning of words like febrile, imprecations, or gamine, all of which appear within the first 50 pages of Hidden Sins. Reading aloud forces us to decelerate nightly, but I'm happy to report that it also works to slow down longer stretches of time. It took us a full year to read Shadow and Bone. Alone, I probably would have finished all three books in 1 or 2 months. I'm glad I didn't. Maybe nobody's read aloud to you since your mother or father helped put you to sleep. Maybe you haven't read aloud to anyone since you were that mother or father, your baby now grown up. It's not too late to start again. None of us can tell what sorrows or misfortunes await. What we can do is choose a great book with our partner, something with solid plot, good pacing, genre doesn't matter. Read the first page, pass the book, read another page, repeat for the chapter, the book, the trilogy, for the week, the year, for life. Over in Culture and News, Dolly Parton reveals she won't be touring again because she needs to be with her husband. In a new interview, Dolly makes a rare mention of her husband, Carl Thomas Dean. The Queen of Country is at it again with her latest album, Rockstar, which features an extensive list of other A-list singers and songwriters, Elton John, Debbie Harry, Sting, just to name a few. There are over 30 songs, including 9 original tracks, so naturally, fans are wondering when they can see Dolly Parton on tour. As epic as we know it would be, Parton has confirmed once again that she will no longer be touring. In a recent interview with Good Housekeeping to promote her new album and book, Behind the Seams, My Life in Rhinestones, on Talk Shop Live, Parton revealed the main reason she stopped touring. "I don't tour anymore," Parton said with a laugh. "I've got so many business things I'm doing, and my husband and I are getting older. He's a little older than I am, and I kind of need to be with him." Parton also noted that the time it takes to bring a tour together is a big commitment regardless of how old you are. "You got to be committed to that, and I did that all my life." But don't be too disappointed. Parton says she's definitely open to performing the songs with the other artists for an award show or some other television special. "And even if we can't go to a Dolly show, we can rest assured knowing at least she's got no plans to retire. I might take off, you know, a month instead of a week, but no, I don't plan to ever retire unless my husband was sick and really needed me, or I was sick. That'd be the only 2 reasons I would ever quit, and let's hope that never happens." Amen, Dolly. Still in Culture and News, Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake almost had a baby together, memoir expert reportedly reveals. The two ultimately decided not to carry out the pregnancy. Britney Spears' memoir, The Woman in Me, is not out yet, but the bombshells from it are already leaking. According to TMZ, the pop singer reveals in her book that ex-Justin Timberlake got her pregnant in the early 2000s, but that after some difficult decisions, they agreed she would get an abortion. Spears reportedly thought Timberlake was the love of her life when they were dating and initially wanted to have his baby, but was conflicted by the decision. Ultimately, they decided not to carry out the pregnancy. Spears and Timberlake were the it couple of the early 2000s, but after 3 years of dating, they split in 2002. Timberlake went on to marry Jessica Biel in 2012. Spears, meanwhile, married Jason Allen Alexander in 2004, only to call it off 2 days later. She was then married to Kevin Federline from 2004 to 2007, and later wed Sam Asghari in 2022. The two split earlier this year. She shares sons Sean, 18, and Jaden, 17, with Federline. The big baby reveal comes after sources told Page Six that Timberlake is concerned about Spears' book release. "He's very curious what she'll reveal from their relationship," one insider said. "It's eating at him." Spears, however, opened up about her intention behind penning the book in a new rare interview with People, and said the book is nothing but her first opportunity to tell her own life story. "Over the past 15 years, or even at the start of my career, I sat back while people spoke about me and told my story for me," she said. "After getting out of my conservatorship, I was finally free to tell my story without consequences from the people in charge of my life." The Woman in Me is available for pre-order now via BritneyBook.com, Amazon, and other places where books are sold. It was released on October 24th, and this article was from Harper's Bazaar Us. Here are some audiobook recommendations from Oprah's Quarterly Magazine. Big Swiss by Jen Biegun, B-E-A-G-I-N. 40-something Greta, still drifting between addresses and careers, has wound up in the inbred hipster paradise of Hudson, New York, where she gets a job as a transcriber for the town's popular sex therapist. Having listened to the jaw-dropping recordings of his sessions with Big Swiss, Greta never should have met the woman, much less fallen for her, but she does. Smart, sexy, and achingly funny, this addictive novel is all about the guilty pleasure of spying into other people's lives. This next one is Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid. That's R-E-I-D. If you haven't already devoured the Amazon Prime limited series based on Reid's novel, and even if you have, the audio production is a perfect vehicle for this rock and roll soap opera. An all-star cast fills out the band and their entourage. Particularly lovable are Judy Greer as keyboardist Karen and Benjamin Bratt as Billy's younger brother, Graham. The next one is Life and Other Love Songs by Anissa, A-N-I-S-S-A, Gray. This affecting story of a black family comes to life in audio, braiding the evocative voices of three brilliant voice actors to tell a story of love, betrayal, and secrets kept for decades. Deborah, a singer, and Oz met as teenagers in Detroit in the early 60s. Dominic Hoffman perfectly conveys both Oz's quiet decency and his racking guilt, while Karen Murray's musical voice is perfect for Deborah. Nicole Lewis is warm and funny as the girl who somehow keeps her head above water through it all. Hey, this is an item on Oprah's list, the O List. If you're interested in purchasing it, it's called Feet Cute. Cozy slippers are seasonless, but on crisp fall days, they're especially soul-soothing. This plaid pair is cushioned to perfection and made for both short walks outside and full days of leisure indoors. They're by Subu, S-U-B-U, tweed slippers, and they're $90 at Amico, AMEICO.com. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.